Welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on journalistic fraud. Journalistic fraud comes in a number or a variety of forms. Distorting with opinion is one of those forms, and it comes in four methodologies. It's quoting someone who agrees with you, or directly injecting your own opinion, or omitting the opposing opinion to your thesis, or faking fairness and balance. I always like the Lair News Hour for faking fairness and balance. They try to make it look like we're trying to be fair and even-handed and giving both sides equal time, when in reality it's always overbalanced on liberal philosophy. Distorting a story with opinion by including someone else's speculation, or by directly injecting your own views into the story, is another basic technique of disguising a newspaper's political viewpoint in the form of a straight news story. Opinions may be employed for influencing public opinion in the following basic ways: quoting someone who agrees with you, directly injecting your opinion, omitting the opposing opinion, or faking fairness and balance. Now let's take a look at these one at a time. Quoting someone who agrees with you. Readers of Bernard Goldberg's Bias may recall an excellent account of how reporters use the opinions of experts as a means of conveying the views of the reporter. A news organization may insert into a story its own editorial views by actively seeking and then reporting the opinion of someone who agrees with the editors. Coulter accurately called this the quote someone who agrees with you technique. Good reporters develop a reservoir of people in politics, business, education, and other circles that they can count on for a quote reflecting their paper's opinion on any subject. The kind of people who a reporter can draw upon for just the right quote includes a partisan politician, a political pundit, or some other expert, or it could come from just Joe Sixpack walking down the street. Quoting partisan politicians. One reporter rarely has trouble finding a partisan politician ready to serve up a lively quote that is consistent with the Times opinion without a person or subject. In a headline titled "Democrats Seek a Stronger Focus and Money," published May 26, 2003, the front page of the Times carried a colorful quote by the vice chairwoman of the Colorado Democratic Party. She called President Bush the village idiot from Texas. And early in the 2000 presidential race, Al Gore gave a cue to the left wing of his party that he was going to connect Bush with racism and bigotry. In dueling speeches, Gore and Bradley tried to court preeminent and prominent Democrats, September 26, 1999. Let me read that again. In dueling speeches, Gore and Bill Bradley try to court prominent Democrats. Now, both men, the story goes on to say, saved their sharpest criticism for the Republican front runner, Governor George W. Bush of Texas, and his reluctance to expand his state's hate crimes law. "I'm for affirmative action because it's still needed," Mr. Gore said, "and I'm also for the passage of a hate crimes law. When James Byrd is dragged from the back of a pickup truck because of his race, when Matthew Shepard is crucified on a split rail fence by bigots, how can any political leader in either party say that there is not a difference between hate crimes and other crimes?" Well, the article read like a press release for the Democratic contenders, with Gore's statement going unchallenged by any Republican or independent free speech advocate. Hate crimes laws would increase penalties if the accused uttered any racial, bigoted, sexist, or similarly non-politically correct statement during the commission of a crime. Later, during the campaign, Gore supporters ran a highly publicized advertisement that featured a graphic reminder of Byrd's murder, in which his surviving daughter associated the crime with Bush's stance on hate crime laws. The Gore campaign disavowed any association with the ad. Now, as we will explore in the next chapter, when quoting a politician, A paper will try to manipulate the credibility of the speaker by the use of creative labeling. That's creative labeling. For example, a Republican might be labeled a staunch conservative, ultra-conservative, or far right-wing conservative, even extremist. Liberal Republicans and most Democrats are labeled moderates and centrists. Now, quoting experts, there's no shortage of experts on a variety of political specialties from economics to foreign policy who would be delighted to be quoted in the New York Times. Good reporters have a pool of political pundits working for liberal think tanks or just about anyone who has recently written a book on political affairs. They're at their disposal to support any story that a reporter may want to write. College professors are an easily accessible source of liberal opinion. The overwhelming majority of professors at universities like Harvard, Yale, and Georgetown are left-leaning, and their association with the Ivy League provides instant credibility for just about any editorial slant that the Times chooses to place on a story. Now, by contrast, left-wing economists and businessmen are very rare, but they do exist, and when one is willing to be quoted, the liberal news reporter should, as Polonius in Hamlet put it, grapple them to thy soul with hoops of steel. Well, the New York Times is notorious for having its reporters gin up feature stories that further the paper's ongoing promotion of one liberal cause or another. These articles often find themselves on the front page, and more often than not, their sole basis consists of quotes from one or two experts who agree with the Times' view of the matter. For example, the Times is well known for its vigorous and persistent opposition to the death penalty. They've published over 20 editorials on the subject of the death penalty during the first 3 months of the new millennium, or I should say the first 3 years, 20 stories in 3 years of the new millennium. But despite the Times' spirited editorial diatribe against the death penalty, capital punishment continues to enjoy overwhelming public support, and according to the Times, turned to a more effective means of influencing public opinion on the subject. I should say, accordingly, the Times has turned to a more effective means of influencing public opinion on the subject. So in a front-page news article under the headline, Death Row Numbers Decline as Challenges to System Rise, January 11, 2003. And the Times stated in the article, quote, "For the first time in a generation, the number of inmates on death row has dropped, and the number of new death row inmates in 2001, the most recent year for which comprehensive data is available, was the lowest since 1973. Despite enduring and strong public support for the death penalty, these numbers suggest that those directly involved in the justice system have serious concerns about the way capital punishment is carried out," unquote. With the premise of the story being there are serious concerns about the challenges to the death penalty, you would think that there might be a quote or two in the article supporting that premise, but there's not a single quote in the article that supports serious concerns or challenges. And you're not going to find any in this article. The article does not, or does rather, quote a political science professor from Amherst College, which is a liberal left-wing institution, who has written a book that appears to be aligned with the Times' view of the subject. So here comes, quote, someone who agrees with you. He says, "We're in a period of national reconsideration," said Destin D. Surratt. He's a professor of political science and law at Amherst College. He's also the author of, quote, When the State Kills, unquote, Capital Punishment and the American Condition, published by Princeton University Press in 2001. People are asking if the death penalty is compatible with values which in the American mainstream are taken seriously. Equal protection, due process, protection of the innocent, Professor Surratt said. While supporting the Times' unpopular editorial position against the death penalty, the professor's quote in no way supports the premise of the article published in the Times. And also, it is hard to determine which people the professor is talking about. Public opinion shows that over 70% of the public continue to support the death penalty. More remarkably, the premise that there are serious concerns about how capital punishment is carried out is specifically refuted in the article's next two quotes, both of which attribute the decline in the number of people sentenced to death to refinements in the justice system. The trend has more to do with practical problems than bedrock beliefs, said Richard C. Dieter. He's the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, which opposes capital punishment. Could not the drop in death row inmates be explained by the sharp reduction in violent crime since 1973? Might not that drop be explained at least in part by the increasing willingness of juries to apply the death sentence? The answer to both questions is yes, and the reporter quotes another expert on page 13 where the article continues to that effect. It says, quote, "The fact that the murder rate is down accounts for some of the softening," said Kent Slediger. He's the legal director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, and to some extent it's paradoxical. The death penalty brings down the crime rate, and that lessens the need to impose the death penalty. So the Times then comes up and says, why do you want a death penalty? Because There's been a decline of prisoners on death row. Let me explain it this way. When I was a youngster growing up, we were impressed with the fact that murderers have to pay with their lives. We were taught when I went to public school that there was a moral imperative, and that is, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt do no murder, thou shalt not commit adultery. The Ten Commandments were taught in public school when I was a youngster. So when I went to the first, second, and third grade, we taught morality. That was the norm. And I was always afraid of being gassed or electrocuted for killing somebody. See, in my mindset, I don't kill you because I'm afraid that I would have to pay with my life. And since I don't want to pay with my life, why, I don't want to kill you. Now, it's been reported that we live in an amoral society and crime rates go up. And when they interview people who commit murder, they ask the question, were you concerned about the death penalty when you committed the crime? And almost invariably, the answer is no. No, I was never concerned about the death penalty being imposed when I committed this crime. Now, in the Bible, God uses the term hear and fear, which attaches to the death penalty, that these people will hear and fear. If you were taught to fear the penalty from the time you're a child growing up, I think, and I've always thought that you'd have far less crime. At least we did 50 or 75 years ago. Today, people are no longer fearful of the death penalty because we don't have a moral code taught in our public schools. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And that is, in essence, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Well, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper, like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Now, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin in clad coin or currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there is a 7 or 8 to 1 difference in purchasing power and a 7 or 8 to 1 difference in the taxes that are due on the paper money versus the gold money. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well, in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin to take away the people's right to property and then destroy their property rights, which is what the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, for more information about private business, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's very informative, it's entertaining, and it's educational and free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. And my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to your website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and then send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the book Journalistic Fraud, published by WND Books, Nashville, Tennessee. And you can reach them on the internet at WND. See if I got that right. I'm trying to do that from memory. WNDbooks.com. Go to www.WNDbooks.com. Written by Bob Cohn. It's called Journalistic Fraud. I rate it a 1 in 20 read. You'll have to read 20 books along this line before you'll find one that's as good as this. Talk about an expose. I said earlier that he was a reporter with the Times. That's a mistake. He wasn't a reporter. He's an avid reader, the book says. He's an attorney. And he's been reading the Times, I guess, most of his life, and he's read a couple of other books on fraud, which he cited here in his own book, particularly the fraud created by media spin. Spin is the term that they use, and it's a lie. They lie to us, and then they don't want to say, well, we're lying to you. And so they use the more politically correct term, spin. They'll say, well, this is the White House spin on today's events, which is the same as saying, well, this is the White House lie on today's events. Now, the second way that we can do this fraud by opinion is by directly injecting our own opinions into a news story that we're alleging is just a factual story. It's unbiased. Now, in the case of the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, I'm a partisan. I'm opposed to evolution and evolutionary philosophy, and I'm a pro-Bible, pro-special creation. And I don't make any bones about it, and that's my opinion, and I express my opinion, and I support it with names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. But I'm not claiming that I'm fair or even-handed, and I don't bring in an evolutionist to express his views on my nickel. If he wants to express his views, he can go on the McNeil Lair News Hour or on the New York Times, not my show. I have to pay for this time. And if I'm going to pay for it, I'm going to express my views. And he can buy his time and express his views. So I'm not making any bones about being a partisan. I've got my views and I express them. But the New York Times is appearing as if they're just reporting the news. Listen to the evolutionist and listen to the special creationist and listen to their stories and make up your own mind. So what they do is they use psychopolitics for the express purpose of influencing you in your decisions in what you believe is a straight news story when in reality it isn't. And we can do this by directly injecting our own opinion into the story, and we do that in 8 forms. Politicians, experts, and common people are not the only sources of opinion that a reporter can drop into the story to slant the news. Now, there is a 4th source of expert opinion, the reporter himself, where the reporter directly injects his own opinion or that of his editors into the story that he's writing. So a reporter can cleanly inject his own opinion into the news story in a way that's virtually unnoticeable by simply calling upon fictional people to present their views. Now, here are a few examples. Number 1, have you ever read the term experts feel? Number 2, critics believe. Number 3, it is widely thought. Number 4, observers say. Number 5, European leaders feel. Number 6, Americans believe. Number 7, history suggests. Or number 8, most economists believe. Now let's run through those again. When you hear the term, or you read this term, experts feel, but they don't come up with any names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, or evidence in support of these experts who feel what? Or critics believe. No names, no dates, no times, no places, facts, witnesses, or evidence. It is widely thought. Widely thought by who? Again, no names, dates, times, places. Observers say. Who are these observers and what do they say? When did they say it? Again, no names, dates, times, or places. European leaders feel. How do we know European leaders feel? How many European leaders feel? It doesn't give us any names, dates, times, or places. Americans believe. Americans believe what? Canadians believe. Canadians believe what? Australians believe. Australians believe what? We don't have any names, dates, times, or places here. History suggests. What does history suggest? When did history suggest it? We don't know. It doesn't say. But we're assured that history suggests. Most economists believe. Most implies 50% or more. Most economists believe. Who took the poll? Who has the names? When was the poll taken? You know, using fictitious persons to advance an editorial opinion is so common that not only would it be impractical to list all of the recent examples here, it would be unnecessary, as you merely need to pick up a copy of today's New York Times to find this technique employed by one reporter or another. The practice is so frequently employed that occasionally you find the technique used not only multiple times in the same story, but more than once in the same paragraph. In an article under the headline, Bush Wants Tax Cuts Sooner to Aid Economy This Year, February 5, 2001, the New York Times demonstrated how far it is willing to go to oppose tax cuts proposed by the Bush administration. The Times had just published a flurry of editorials opposing Bush's tax cut plans. Interpreting Mr. Greenspan on January 25, 2001, Medicine for the Economy, February 1, 2002, The Estate Tax Folly, February 3, 2001. However, as the Times was well aware, a more effective way to influence the public to oppose the Bush tax cuts would be to make the editorial case against it in the form of a straight news article. So rather than suggest the tax relief would not improve the economy, the Times believed that it would simply come too late to help the economy. So the Times printed the following unsupported statement, quote, many economists doubt that the tax relief can be enacted quickly enough to make much difference in the economy this year, unquote. Well, needless to say, none of these many economists were quoted in the article. There are no names of these many economists. There are no dates when these many economists said whatever it was that they said in support of the Times position. In other words, the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, which is the standard of proof required in court. For me to make a statement in court, I have to have proof. I must produce a witness. The witness must testify under oath that what he's testifying to is true, accurate, and correct. We don't need that in the newspaper. We don't need any proof. We need just naked, stark allegations. We should be a lot more critical in the way we read news articles. and a lot more critical in the conclusions that we come to based upon those articles. Needless to say, none of these many economists were quoted in the article, and considering for a moment the substance of this line of thought, what difference would it make if tax relief couldn't have an effect before the end of the year? What if it had an effect by the end of next year? Wouldn't that be better than no effect at all? Well, if the tax relief could improve the economy by early the following year, would not many economists support that? And why would an economist be considered an expert on the length of time that it would take Congress to enact legislation? And as to timing of the legislation, the article referred to another anonymous group. They're called Republican leaders. Well, these Republican leaders in Congress say they probably cannot send a tax bill to Mr. Bush this summer, suggesting that any changes in withholdings would take effect in late summer or early fall. Well, we know today that Congress passed the relief bill on May 11, 2001, and over a month before the start of summer. And either the Republican leaders were wrong or the Times was wrong, but we won't know because the Times didn't quote any of these Republican leaders to support the statements attributed to them in the Times article. Now, rounding out the sums, or rounding out rather the Times, the thesis that tax relief was unneeded, the article employed the classic history suggests trick to inject the paper's opinion, and then they concluded that history suggests that the economy is likely to be recovering by then, especially since the Federal Reserve is already cutting interest rates and is considered likely to continue doing so in the coming months, unquote. Did you catch that? History suggests. You're listening to The Law Hour, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai about 3,100 years ago, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits, such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. That's a bunch. Well, George Bush Sr. back in 1992, and then George Bush Jr. in the 2000 election said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. Is that really true? Is that what you wanted, was a job? But, you know, jobs was not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments, because all of these authorities, God, Moses, they all recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in employment. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business and sales. It's not and never has been in public business, and certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. You may make a living, but not make any money. Now it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract, and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called real property, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults and order my free General Law CD package. Now, and that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Or you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click on the email, send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look here at omitting the opposing opinion. If I express my opinion and I omit any conflicting opinion, I can influence you in that way. I do that every day here on the editorial review. I will express my opinion without giving a corresponding opinion, or an opposing opinion, I guess I should say, from my opponents. But as I said earlier, I'm not coming to you with a news article. I'm coming to you with an editorial opinion. That's what editorial means. It's my opinion. When you go to the editorial page of the newspaper, it's the editorial opinion. Here's what I think. It's like letters from the listeners. You know, you say, well, what's your opinion? What do you think? You express your opinion. What we are calling on the carpet here, what we're exposing, is a practice of editorializing, but doing it in the form of a news article, which is leaving you with the impression that we're unbiased. I'm biased. I'm opinionated. I'm a partisan. I don't make any bones about it. But the New York Times comes to you and says, well, we're not opinionated. We're not expressing opinions. We're just reporting the facts. We're just reporting the news. Let the chips fall where they may. As old Mark Twain used to say, that's a lie, a damned lie, or a statistic. Now we call it spin, which is just another polite term for saying he's a liar. Now, when they leave out opposing opinions, then it's not a straight news article, it's a biased editorial opinion. Otherwise known as writing the one-sided story, omitting the opposing opinion can become a most powerful means of bias. And a paper may report a story by merely quoting people whose opinion agrees with its editors and completely ignoring the other side. The best examples of this technique appear in articles about a liberal issue that the Times editors are especially eager to champion. An article under the headline, Panel Calls for Higher Mileage Standards, published July 13, 2001. The panel might well have been the editorial staff of the New York Times, reported that a subcommittee of the House of Representatives voted to require car makers to raise the fuel economy of sport utility vehicles and minivans. The article quoted a spokesman for the Sierra Club, a liberal environmental organization, but no one from the automobile industry, which opposed the measure, was mentioned in the article. The headline states, the headline says, quote, states poorest facing loss of U.S. aid, February 10th, 2001, should make any decent person shudder. But you have to read halfway through the article to learn about the safety net in place that betrays the alarmist headline. Of course, the article quotes and paraphrases a poor people's advocacy group and a liberal-leaning group, but no one who might be said to favor welfare reform. So why bother? A lead front-page article referred to previously, which says Bush slashing aid for EPA cleanup at toxic sites, July 1st, 2001. Well, the facts of which we said actually supported a headline such as EPA toxic cleanup funding increase still not enough, quoted spokesman from two environmental groups. One was the Edison Wetlands Association, and the other is the League of Conservation Voters. No one from the EPA was quoted, and nor was anyone else who might have supported the Bush administration's management of the cleanup of toxic waste sites. In a headline entitled, Drug Companies Increase Spending on Efforts to Lobby Congress, published July 1, 2003, the Times wrote about the industry's lobbying plans for the coming year by disclosing portions of what it identified as confidential budget documents. And from the leading Drug Industry Trade Association, while printing numerous excerpts from the internal documents, the Times quoted no one from the Trade Association in their article. Steve Brill, who is a media critic writing at media website, it's Poynter, P-O-Y-N-T-E-R.org, June 2nd, 2003, observed this. He said, quote, what's missing should be clear to anyone who's ever taken a high school journalism class. No effort to get the lobby group itself to commit. And if the explanation is that someone at the Times thinks quoting from the internal memos is allowing the group to speak for itself, that's not only absurd, but it also is dangerous in the sense that nowhere in the story are we ever told that the reporter confirmed with the group that the internal documents are real and that they aren't fake or aren't superseded by later drafts, unquote. Well, let's take a look at this opinion and opinion making here for a second. I used to be a lobbyist in the Idaho legislature, lobbying for various citizens who were opposed to various pieces of legislation which were being promoted by big business, primarily, big business or government. Now, notice here that the Times put a headline in. It says, Panel Calls for Higher Mileage Standards. Well, who wouldn't be in favor of higher mileage? Well, how about the oil industry, for one? I mean, after all, the oil industry is selling gasoline, aren't they? Just like the media or the television industry is selling televisions. And after they've sold you one television to put in your living room, they would like to sell everybody a second television to put in their bedrooms. And then they would like to sell you a third television to put in everybody's kitchen, let's say. And why is that? Well, if you're a businessman, you're in the business of manufacturing something and selling it. Doctors want more patients. Dentists want more customers. Television companies that manufacture televisions want more people to buy more TVs, and oil companies want people to buy more gasoline. Now, from the point of view of the oil industry, they've got this resource under the ground, and they want to pump it out of the ground, convert it to gasoline, and sell it to you. Didn't President Bush tell us after 9/11 that he wanted us to go out and spend money and stimulate the economy and make it work. Well, why is it then that we're supposed to go out and spend our money, but we're not supposed to spend our money on more gasoline? What are we supposed to spend our money on? Are we supposed to buy more cars, but not more gasoline? I mean, why don't they come out and say, Bush administration or congressional panel advocates making fewer cars and making repairs and making your cars last longer. Or instead of two cars per family, we should only have one car. I remember back in Herbert Hoover's day, it was Herbert Hoover promised to give every American a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. All right, so we went out and now we got two cars in every garage, now three cars, and then you got three children, they all have cars. Isn't that what business is all about, making automobiles and selling them? Making gasoline and selling it, making television sets and selling it? I mean, you know, if we followed this kind of logic through, why would we want to penalize or zero in on one industry, the oil industry, and say, well, we want higher mileage so that we can sell less gas? Why don't we come out and say, we ought to have an embargo on plastic so that you make fewer television sets, so that families, instead of having three television sets, only have two? It'd make just as much sense and probably save more energy if we had fewer consumer goods. But 67% of the American economy is predicated upon consumerism. I'm not here to tell you that's good or bad, right or wrong. I'm here to tell you that that's what your economy is based on, consumption, not production. Personally, I think we'd be better off with a production economy rather than a consumption economy, but you know, I don't make the rules. The people of America have gone along with our politicians. They suggested that we buy into the NAFTA free trade program, and we did. That's a liberal ideology. Not a conservative one, a liberal ideology. And Al Gore wants us to cut back on oil consumption. And I'm sitting here saying, why would we cut back on oil consumption any more than auto consumption, television consumption, or carpet consumption, or housing consumption, or any other consumption? Why zero in on one industry? No, the truth is, we should have lower fuel standards so that automobiles burn more gas, so that you'll spend more money buying more gasoline. I mean, after all, that's what consumerism is all about. And again, I'm not saying that I'm for that. I'm for developing the 4 trillion barrels of oil that we have in oil shale in America, telling those Arabs to take their oil and stick it where there's no daylight. But I'm not in favor of zeroing in on one industry and discriminating against that industry over another. Can you think of any intelligent reason why we should be doing that? Well, hang on. We'll take a little break here and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Law Hour. The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. Then while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, Joe puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and then shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. After cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico how much money can he spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany, goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. And at the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, and ponders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Does that ring a bell? You know, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Why doesn't Joe go to work in the area of production instead of consumption? I know it's a wild new concept, but if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, entertaining, educational, and it's free of charge. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about journalistic fraud published by WND Books. They're located in Nashville, Tennessee. This copy is $27.95, comes from Barnes & Noble. You can go to their website, wndbooks.com. It's an easy one, wndbooks.com. I rated a 1 in 20 read. I think it's an important facet or aspect to incorporate into your fund of knowledge when you pick up the New York Times, or for that matter, any newspaper in America, USA Today, or your local Yellow Journal. Remember, it's probably hooked up to the New York Times wire service, and the propaganda that the New York Times is publishing in the guise of news is, in reality, editorial opinion. Now, you may subscribe to that editorial opinion, or you may not. But if you don't, and you read it in the Times, don't believe it because it's published in the newspaper, because it's probably not true. Now, Now, taking another look at, or the final look at, faking fairness and balance, remember there's four elements that we're looking at here. Quoting someone who agrees with you, directly injecting your opinion, omitting the opposing opinion, or faking fairness and balance. And I said, I can't think of anybody that does this better than the Lehrer NewsHour. They bring in various people to give their opinions and views. And it appears when they have four on there that there's two liberals and two conservatives. Actually, you have two liberals and two moderates. Nobody ever comes on the NewsHour and espouses gold and silver coin, the Ten Commandments, or the traditional values of our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Nobody ever comes on there and espouses the views of public school versus home school. They'll talk about public school, and then they'll talk about the various aspects of public school, such as, well, should we have public schools with vouchers or public schools without vouchers? How about eliminating public school altogether or making public school voluntary and optional? How about making public school payable by the people that use it? I mean, there's all kinds of things that we could talk about concerning public school to make it appear like, boy, this is a well-rounded give and take over education. No, it isn't. It's a biased, slanted opinion. It's an opinion poll concerning public school. There's three schools that you could send your children to. It's parochial school, that's your local Catholic or Baptist school. There's home school, and there's public school, so it's public, home, and private. You have three selections to make. I've never heard anybody espouse parochial and home schools in any education forum that I have ever listened to on TV, radio, or newspapers. And the only place you'll hear that is here on the Law, to my knowledge. The problem with this one-sided story technique is that it is the one means of bias that is most readily understood as bias by the average reader. Being that it is the prototypical form of bias, the Times uses the technique sparingly. There is, however, a clever alternative one-sided story that fakes a balance. Faking the balance, reporting only one side while making it appear that you're reporting both, was employed to perfection by the Times in a lead story on the front page under the headline, Parties Jousting Over Wrongdoing by U.S. Business. The hard news was a report that President Bush was planning to announce during a trip to New York City, the administration's response to the corporate accounting scandals that had plagued the stock market earlier in the year. The Times didn't appear to have any further information on what the president was going to say, and without that information, there wasn't much of a story, especially not one warning front page coverage. Now, remember, the Times is not about reporting the news as much as it is about influencing your opinion. So given that the president was going to give a speech the next day in the Times' own backyard on Wall Street, the paper was not shy about taking the initiative to advance their opposition to Bush. The result was the following lead that appeared on the front page of the Times on the day of Bush's speech. Washington, July 7th. The two political parties opened a critical week of jousting today over how to respond to corporate wrongdoing, with Democrats seeking to exploit what they see as President Bush's vulnerability on this issue and business executives pressing for action to restore confidence in the financial markets. So when the president's entourage arrived in New York that morning for the speech, they found that before Bush uttered a single word, the front page of the Times had already transformed what was to be a policy speech by the President of the United States into what the newspaper now defined as a mere thrust in a political joust. Now, more important, in a lead that begins two political parties, note how only the position of the Democratic Party is mentioned. The Republican Party is eliminated and ignored. It was important to get across the notion that the Democrats see the corporate scandal as President Bush's vulnerability. It was equally important that the Times bury, actually omit, what the Republicans are charging, that the accounting scandals, particularly the earnings announcements upon which they were based, all took place during the 8-year watch of Bill Clinton and the Clinton administration, a point not mentioned at all in this article, that the revelations, investigations, prosecutions, and plans for reform were all occurring during the Bush administration, was something that must be suppressed at all cost. Now, like doing the tango, it takes two to joust. Where is the other side of the story? Where is the Republican side of the story? It's not here. To avoid reporting the Republican side of the joust, the Times came up with, as an apparent counterpoint to the Democrats' attack, business executives pressing for action. It doesn't tell us who. Thus, the jousting, a game usually played by two opponents, was spun to be a Democrats exploiting Bush's vulnerability on the one side and a business executives pressing Bush for action on the other. So, as for the news, it finally arrived in the next paragraph, but was prefaced brilliantly by a gratuitous slam at Bush using two of our old friends, the anonymous, on the defensive, and criticism. So after being put on the defensive by questions about his role in the stock sale a dozen years ago and criticism of his administration as having failed to act aggressively enough against fraud and mismanagement, Mr. Bush will set out his latest plan in a speech in New York on Tuesday. So did you notice that? We're not even going to bring up the other side. We'll insert our opinion and leave the other side out. Now, with the Lehr News Hour, what they do is they come in, and newspapers do the same thing. I'm just zeroing in on the Lehr News Hour now, because if they take a topic, they present the leftist view, the far left view, and then the opposite to that is the centrist or the moderate view, never the extreme right view. If you've heard it, let me know, would you? I haven't. So this book, written by Bob Cohn, to expose this kind of bias, should put all of us on notice that we're being manipulated, and we're being manipulated with intent. It's not an accident. It's being done because the far left controls the media. By and large, they control the media. It doesn't mean that every program is far left. This one isn't. Rush Limbaugh isn't. Many other talk show news-type programs, especially on talk radio, are controlled by the right. Now, do they use the same tactics? Yep, they do. They do. The same kinds of tactics are used by the right and the left, with the justification is, well, they do it, and so we have to do it to counter them. I disagree, and I dissent from that opinion. I think that George Bush is guilty enough that we can just tell the truth about him and hang it. And the worst thing that can happen to you is that your opponents tell the truth about you. I'm opposed to this lying and chicanery about George Bush. Some of it he's guilty of, and some of it he isn't. And when he isn't, we ought to label just exactly what happened. That's what news is all about. Opinion is where, here's what I think we ought to do about it. This is what my conclusion is. Here's what I do. When students go to school here at the law school, I tell them very plainly, I don't know what's good for you. I'm barely able to determine what's good for me. So why don't you make up your own mind? Well, we're running out of time. I'm going to have to cut it off right there. We'll be back again tomorrow night, and we'll talk about this thing some more concerning journalistic fraud. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour and the editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. It says our time is up. We're going to have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.